Just a quick couple notes about the Psalms as we're starting off our Bible reading. Some of us maybe are new to the book of Psalms and just wanted to make a few notes. Psalms is a book basically that is a hymnal for the Jewish people. And they would use these to sing. We don't have the notes that go along with these words, but it's definitely, they're very poetic. And you can see how they would be just right for songs. And a lot of times, in fact, people do come along and make them rhyme, force them to rhyme, and then put some notes to them. And sometimes we sing those songs as well. But the Book of Psalms is this hymnal for the Jews. One of the interesting things about the Psalms that we're going to highlight today is about these descriptions that many of the Psalms have. If you look at the book of Psalms, open up anywhere, but here in chapter 4 you see these words that are either italicized or words that are smaller. For example, in chapter 4 or Psalm 4, the evening prayer of trust in God. This is going to be a title that the publishers add into the book of Psalms. That's not part of the book of Psalms. That's something that the publishers add in, whether they're helpful or not, but just to describe what the psalm is about. But then underneath that, there are some other words that say, for the choir director on stringed instrument, the Psalm of David. Now these words, whether they are original to the psalm or not, they have been with the psalm for the longest time. And as proof of that, when you look at the book of Psalms, the book of Psalms itself, it is organized to some extent according to these titles. The first book, there are five books in the book of Psalms, and the first two books primarily are psalms that are written by David. And it looks like there has been some determination by the compiler to put the Psalms of David in these particular areas. And so whether or not these are words that are original with the Psalms themselves, that David wrote this, by the way, this is a Psalm of David, or not, they are definitely ancient. And they may have some very accurate accurate information about the psalm that can be useful as we read through it. So these psalms, these descriptions are give us information about the author who wrote the psalm, the composer. They give us information about the historical context. For example, Psalm 3 talks about a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. And then it talks about how or who is going to play the psalm. Some psalms do not have these descriptions. Sometimes these are called orphan psalms, only because we don't know where they come from exactly. Psalm 1 and 2, for example, if you turn over there, you can see that they don't have any particular description no one claims these psalms. However, Psalm 2, we know that it comes from is a psalm of David from other contexts in from other texts in the Bible. But if you come to Psalm 3, for example, Psalms 3 has this description, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. And when we have this historical snippet, this historical background, it really makes the psalm come alive with a different meaning. When you talk about David's son Absalom, when he's fleeing from that's kind of a surprising title if you're not familiar with the story of the Bible. Absalom's story is a complicated story. But when you try to boil it down to the basic essentials, Absalom was very angry with his father for a number of reasons, and he desired for himself to become king in his father's place. And so in 2 Samuel 15, Absalom gathers men to himself, conspires against his father, and he's going to take Jerusalem by force. Absalom comes into Jerusalem. David decides, instead of fighting with Absalom, he is going to flee from Absalom, leave Jerusalem for Absalom. Absalom is finally defeated, but David does not return to Jerusalem until 2 Samuel 19. But until that time, he's hunted by his own son. Could you imagine the feelings that he has when all of this happens? Now, when we have this in our mind, then Psalm 3 has some deep meaning to it when we read these verses. For example, verses 1 and 2 say, "O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God." Selah. And Selah, many times, we don't know exactly what it means. It could mean pause. So it might be appropriate just to pause instead of saying Selah. Or it could mean crescendo. It could mean any number of musical, it's some type of musical notation that the meaning is actually lost to us. But these words, you can imagine, here is Absalom, and he is gathering people to himself. All of Jerusalem is turning against David. He is going around and saying, you know, if I were king, we would do things differently. Well, look how bad this... And he wins the hearts of the people against his own father. And so his adversaries are increasing. People are saying there's no deliverance for David. He is in the depths of despair. But look in verse 5. Despite all of this, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000 of people who have set themselves around about. In spite of the fearful events around him, David slept peacefully, trusting in the Lord. Even if there were 10,000 that were to attack David, he would not be afraid. This is a tremendous amount of faith. If you think of 10,000 people, and I'm sure this is poetic and this is exaggeration, but David really meant these things. He is a man of faith. He will not be afraid because he has God on his side. This tremendous amount of faith in the ability and the strength of God. Last week, Joe talked about, "O ye of little faith." These disciples who continually doubt Jesus and really don't comprehend who Jesus was. David was not a man of little faith. He was a man of great faith. Psalm 4 comes along, and again we have a beginning or a descriptor to this psalm. "For the choir director on stringed instruments, a psalm of David." Unlike the previous psalm, we don't have a historical reference. But maybe as we read through this psalm, we can kind of tell what the historical context is. Let's read through this psalm. It says, "Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me in my distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Many are saying, who will show us any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. You have put gladness in my heart, more than when their grain and new wine abound. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety." What does this look like? What does this sound like when we talk about maybe a historical context? Especially when you come to, in verse 2, it says, "O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception?" I don't know that we can securely or with 100% know what the historical context of this psalm is. But in verse 2, when it says, "How long will my honor become a reproach?" That's kind of an odd saying. How long will my honor, the thing that gives me glory, become a reproach? It's kind of an odd idea. What might that be talking about? What comes to my mind, whether this is right or not, reminds me of the time when David has been anointed king. He's been anointed king, and who is pursuing him? rather than Absalom. It's Saul that is pursuing him. He knows that David is going to become the next king. Well, that's a huge honor. But it's this very fact that David is going to become the king is the reason why Saul is pursuing him. And this has become a reproach to him. How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? Maybe this could be defined any moment in the life of David and all the enemies that he has. Worthless men aiming at deception, working against him. But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. Thinking of David, God has set apart every godly man in some sense. But thinking of David and how he had been set apart for a particular cause, specifically that he would become the anointed, or that he was the anointed one. He would become the next king of Israel. Psalm 2 speaks a lot about how God has declared who his anointed one would be. Well, this is David and who he will be. God has declared it. The Lord hears when I call to him. So in spite of whatever the historical context might be, David thinks about his station in life, and he declares his trust in the Lord. He's confident about the Lord's protection. The Lord hears me when I call. And then he says in verse 4, something powerful. He says, tremble and do not sin. Meditate on your heart. Or meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Tremble and do not sin. Again, what's going on in the life of David? I don't know. But what comes to mind is 1 Samuel 26. Read with me 1 Samuel 26. And this is just an amazing attitude that David has. Twice, something similar to this occurs in the life of David. He is being chased by Saul, the king. David is going to be the king. God has declared that this is what's going to happen. But right now, there is another king on the throne of Israel. And David feels that it is not right for him to just knock off Saul and take his place. He's going to wait for the Lord to make that decision. So, for example, in 1 Samuel 26, in verse 6, it says, David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, who will go up with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. And Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Therefore, now, please let me strike him down with a spear to the ground. With one stroke, I will not strike him a second time. So here, picture this. They come at night into the camp, and there is Saul. Saul is the one who's trying to kill David. And there's a spear right next to his head. There's Abner sleeping. Abner is the general of Saul. He's the one that's supposed to be protecting Saul. And Abner's sleeping on the job. Everybody's asleep, and David is just standing there. It's like his future has just landed into his hands. Abishai says, look, the Lord has given you this. You don't get a second chance like this. Let me take a strike at him. I will not strike again. I'm going to do this right. He will be dead. You will be king. All your troubles will be satisfied or done. Look what David says in verse 9. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him. For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? David also said, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him. And his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. And the Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go. And so David took the spear and the jug of water from behind, beside Saul's head, and they went away. But no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. And then afterwards, it talks about, the story goes that David takes these items and shows them to Saul. Saul, I had the opportunity to slay you. I had the opportunity to slay you. And this gives some sort of remorse in Saul, but Saul continues his continues to have a bad relationship with David even to his death. But here is David, this righteous man, and he has the opportunity to slay Saul. But he realizes, this is the Lord's anointed. This is the Lord's chosen one. I can't just slay him and not be guilty. Do you think he was tempted, though? After all these years of fleeing from the law, all these years of fleeing from Saul, do you think there was a temptation in David? Just finish it right now. There was an Abishai, surely. But David understood. David trembled but did not sin. What's interesting about this verse, though, this is not David speaking to himself. This is actually David speaking to his men. When it talks about you, it's a you plural. We don't have the in English, we don't have a you singular and a you plural like you do in other languages. But this right here is a tremble. It's a command to a second person plural. All of you, tremble. All of you, do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. So he is not just encouraging himself. Although this probably is the attitude of David, this is what he wants all of his men to understand. At the base of this is a natural trust that God is going to give the solution to this problem in his time. Be patient, tremble, but do not sin. Meditate, he encourages his soldiers to do. Meditate in your heart upon your bed. A couple of thoughts come to mind. That this is really one of the ways that anyone, and David especially, was able to not sin when he was meditating on the words of God. There is another psalm, Psalm 119. Now, I don't know if it was written by David or not. It sure seems to have a lot of the ideas that David would express. But Psalm 119 expresses, it is a psalm that talks about the glorious things that we read about and can have when we read the Word of God. It's the longest psalm in all the book of Psalms. In fact, the longest chapter in the whole Bible. And it's all about, every single verse is about the Word of God, the law of God. How beautiful is the law of God. How wonderful it is. And look what he says in verse 11. Your Word I have treasured in my heart that I may not sin against you. It really reminds me of David's words here in verse 4, meditate in your heart upon your bed. Think about who God is. Think about what his will is. And when you do that, tremble and do not sin. Making application to us, even today as Christians, this is a little different when you go from English translation from the Hebrew over to an English translation of the Greek in the New Testament. But these are the words from the Septuagint that Paul quotes in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26. It's just interesting to see this attitude, Paul quoting this verse, saying this is the type of attitude that we need to have if we are part of this kingdom, part of this family of God. He says in chapter 4 and verse 26, well, starting in verse 25, it says, therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak truth each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Here it is, verse 26. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. This idea, be angry and do not sin. At least in the psalm, in the context of the psalm, it's more like this be angry, tremble. I know that you are This is a difficult time for you. But don't let that come out in your actions. Instead, what is the attitude of David? Tremble. Let God take care of those difficulties. Tremble and do not sin. How do you do that? By thinking about God, thinking about his power, thinking about his love, and finally, thinking about what his will is for us. So in Psalm 4, in verse 5, he says, offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Many are saying, who will show us any good? So many of David's adversaries, many of David's enemies. Who is going to show them any good? Lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. Look upon us. This reminds me of the words of Moses when he blesses the people of God in Numbers chapter 6. The Lord bless you and keep you. May his countenance shine upon you. He says here, lift up the light of your countenance upon us, O Lord. This is what David wants. He wants God to look upon their adversity. He knows everybody else is looking on their difficulties, but now he wants God to look upon his difficulties. And if God looks upon his difficulties, he has confidence that he will receive blessing. In verse 7, you have put gladness in my heart, utter happiness, more than when there grain and new wine abound. There, not being his people, his soldiers, or himself, he talks about his adversaries. They're doing pretty well right now. Everybody else is doing pretty well. But you know what? I'm happier than they are. They're wealthy, but you know what? I'm happier than they are because I have God looking upon me. Utter happiness and also utter peace. In verse 8, in peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. What a wonderful verse in verse 8 as well. Just this peacefulness that David had. He is being chased by Saul. He is being chased by Absalom. He is running for his life. But he can sleep well at night. Isn't that a strange thing? How does he get to this point? Because he understands who God is. He understands his love for his people. In all of this, David expresses his confidence in God. And maybe we can't know exactly what the historical context of this psalm is with 100% certainty. But whatever the historical context, if he is fleeing from Saul, or maybe he's fleeing from Absalom. It is interesting, just as a side note, it is interesting that here we have in verse 8 a mention of sleep, lying down in sleep. And then also in Psalm 3, in verse 5, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. Could it be that Psalm 4 is only a continuation of the same historical context? I don't know. And maybe it really doesn't matter exactly what the historical context is. But it's kind of strange to me that God or that David would share such personal thoughts about his trials in this psalm, and then write it out as a psalm and then give it to others to sing about. Or just think about this for a moment. Could you imagine writing a song about your own personal struggles? I got up in the morning and had some temptations. This was very difficult. I'm not going to try to sing that for you. And then I'm going to give it to Isaac and say, Isaac, why don't you sing this? This will be good for you. That's kind of a strange, for me, that's difficult to wrap my head about. But David shares this because he realizes that his predicament, his difficulty, his being persecuted and hunted down in the valley of despair, he understands that he's not the only one. And that his difficulties here are, and that even the solution that he finds in the Lord is definitely the solution that we all need as well. In fact, speaking of that, how this is the solution for all of us as well, I find it interesting that as we are reading through the Psalms, that so many of the Psalms, or so many times, one scripture that we read in one completely different part of the Bible really corresponds with what we're reading maybe in Matthew. For example, in our reading through the New Testament right now, we're reading Psalms and also the New Testament. So in chapter 2 of Psalm 2, we talk about God enthroning his king. God has decided and no one will thwart his plan. What did we read about in Matthew chapter 2? Well, King Herod trying to thwart the plan of God, but no one, he couldn't do it. God laughs instead. Here we come to Psalm 4, and we talk about these temptations that David has, the trust that he has to put in God. Look over to Matthew chapter 4, and what do we have? We have the temptations of Jesus himself. I think it's interesting to look at the temptations of Jesus and see that the way that David was able to get the upper hand over the temptations, to win against these temptations, was the same way that Jesus himself did it in when he was tempted. Here we have a window into the temptations of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, it says, "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he became hungry. The tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones become bread.' But he answered and said, 'It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not strike your feet against a stone.' And Jesus said to him, 'On the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test.' Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me.' And Jesus said to him, 'Go, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.' Then the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and began to minister to him." Jesus talks to the devil. He says, "I'm not going to do the things you ask me to do." He is tempted these three times, but with each of those on each of those occasions, he speaks and he defeats these temptations. Just, I'm not going to give a lengthy exposition of this text here, but just some items of significance. Number one, everything the devil promised Jesus and David was already promised by the Father. Here in Matthew chapter 4, you have these promises that the devil makes. He says, "I have all these kingdoms. I will give them to you if you just fall down and worship me." If Jesus is going to continue on with a plan the Father had already given to him, those kingdoms were promised to him. And in fact, in Matthew chapter 28, it says that all authority has been given to me on heaven and on earth. He has all authority. Why? Because he followed the plan of the Father. He says, God will glorify you. God will not let you, or Satan says here in verse 6, throw yourself down from the pinnacle, and the Lord will glorify you in this moment. Jesus says, "You will not put the Lord your God to the test." He answers him. He says, "If you do this right now, the Lord will glorify you. The Father will glorify you." Dude, that's something that's promised by the Father already. This has all been promised, but what the devil is promising, what he's offering, is a shortcut to a false glory. And that really is what sin is all the time, isn't it? God has promised that he will satisfy our every need. Well, what the devil offers so many times are shortcuts to those desires. Do this and you don't have to wait. Do this and you can have it right now. We don't like to wait, do we? But if we trust in the Lord, he has a glory that is true and pure and holy that awaits us. That's what Jesus was waiting for. And in fact, that's what David was waiting for. Abishai was right there, and he says, "Take his life right now. It can be yours." David says, I can't kill the Lord's anointed. I can't do that. In the Lord's time, I will receive what he has promised. Let that be our attitude as well. David and Jesus also defeated temptation how? By trusting in the Father, his power to save. By responding to the words, by responding with the words of the Father. Jesus on every occasion said what? It's an amazing phrase. It is written. You can imagine him shouting this at the devil. It is written. It is written. These things are written, and I will not go against them. But what's important about this, Jesus would not have been saying it is written if he did not know what was written, right? David would not be able to say, it is written, or this is what the Lord says, if he had not been meditating on the word of the Lord. And it's very interesting when you go back and look at every single one of Jesus' responses to the devil. Every single one of those responses, yes, come from the Old Testament, but specifically they come from the book of Deuteronomy. Every single time Jesus responds from the book of Deuteronomy, seems like he's meditating on this particular book. And it's this particular book that when he has these great temptations from the devil, that because he's been meditating on this for 40 days and 40 nights, he's able to bring them out. And this is his source. This is the way he's able to defeat the temptation. And so finally, if considering this, David and Jesus did not have any magic tricks to deal with temptations. They used the same tools available to you and to me. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 4, it talks about how Jesus was tempted. It says in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15, it talks about Jesus as a high priest that can understand who we are. He can understand who we are. It says in verse 15, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. It's not like Jesus got a free pass from temptation. He just settled with temptation and he was able to win over temptation. He was tempted as we are because he was a man. But because he put his trust in God, because David put his trust in God, because they meditated on his word day and night, and because they had that fast relationship with the Father, they were able to send the devil away. Jesus on that time when Peter comes to him and says, no, you're not going to die. What does he say? Get behind me, Satan. Very forcefully. He's not even going to consider it because he's always considering the will of the Father. I hope that these things can be helpful to us as well. Seeing how David dealt with temptation, seeing how Jesus dealt with temptation. And what's amazing to me, how do we get to these points? Well, it's by just very simple, hard work, meditating on the Word of God. We're reading through the New Testament this year. We've started out in the book of Matthew. It's not too late to go ahead and start up. Everybody's trying to work together to read through the book of through the New Testament. And then also we're reading the Psalms and also going to be reading the Proverbs later on. But it's a wonderful way for us to be considering and meditating every day. We need that spiritual nourishment so that we can defeat the temptations that are around us. Let's depend on the Lord. Pray to him. Depend on his will, and he will deliver us. So, thank you.